Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the Haunted Collection with your host, writer, paranormal investigator, and haunted collector Kevin Kane, coming back at you with some more ghostly tales. Welcome back for some more creepy stories. To begin with, as always, I want to invite you to my website, myhaunteddolls.com. There you can shop in the store to buy any of the books I've written, ghost stories, supernatural novels, and a few other things out there that might be of interest. You'll also find a link to my Redbubble store where you can purchase merchandise, t-shirts, hats, accessories, skirts, home and office accessories, phone and pet accessories. There's a lot of stuff out there and a lot of designs with the My Haunted Dolls images and, for this show, the Haunted Collection. So go out there and buy your t-shirt or what have you today and show your support. We really appreciate it. Also, be sure to check out my YouTube channel, My Haunted Dolls, on YouTube. There's a link to it on the links page on myhauntedolls.com, or just simply go to youtube.com/myhauntedolls, and you'll find it. Be sure to subscribe, as weekly I try to post a video of my experiments with the haunted items in my collection, as well as some of the haunted places I've been to, such as last week we went to Sloss Furnace with my special guest, Reese Gadsby from England, who I want to give a shout out to, as I know she'll be listening to this episode, and we hope to have you back again soon, Reese. We really enjoyed it. And so now let's get on with our episode. I'm pretty excited about this story, or it's actually a few stories combined into one. It's about a true incident that happened back in the 70s, about a plane that crashed in the Florida Everglades and the pieces that were used in other airliners. Should always be careful with something from a tragedy like that. Even a piece might have some kind of energy attached to it, as we shall soon find out in the story called The Airline Ghosts. Think of this story next time you're flying in your airline, because you never know, you might have a piece of this flight right there with you. Ghosts are often said to linger around the place where they died. Sometimes that habit takes a curious twist. Take, for example, the ghosts that are associated with Eastern Airlines Flight 401. On the night of Friday, December 29, 1972, Eastern Airlines Flight 401 from New York to Miami was approaching Miami International Airport. In the cockpit, a warning light alerted the crew that something was wrong with the nose landing gear. The pilot of Flight 401, Captain Bob Loft, radioed the tower at Miami that their landing would be delayed. The plane made a wide circle as the crew tried to correct the problem, and apparently they did so. But as Flight 401 came around for a second attempt at a landing, it was much too close to the ground. As a result, the plane crashed into the shallow waters of the Florida Everglades, a few miles from the airport. The crash was witnessed by people on the ground and by other planes that were either arriving or departing from the Miami airport. As far as the air traffic controllers at the airport were concerned, Flight 401 had simply disappeared from their radar screens. If there is such a thing as a soft airplane crash, that is what Flight 401 experienced. The crew apparently was aware of what was about to happen and did everything possible to cushion the impact. The plane crashed in shallow water and did not break up completely. The water also helped douse any fires. Since the crash was well witnessed and close to a major city, help could and did arrive quickly. As a result of this fortunate combination of circumstances, there were survivors of the crash, some 70 of them. But there were more victims than survivors. 101 passengers and crew members died in the crash of Flight 401. Of course, there was an investigation. As usual, it wasn't possible to determine exactly what had happened, since the pilot and others responsible for the operation of the plane had been in the cockpit when the crash occurred and had been killed. The best explanation investigators could come up with was a combination of faulty equipment and pilot error. Either the nose landing gear had actually failed to lower properly, or a faulty warning light told the crew that it had failed. In any case, they were so distracted trying to correct this error that they failed to keep track of the plane's altitude. By the time they realized just how close to the ground they were, it was too late. The plane that had crashed was an L-1011 jumbo jet, a very popular type of aircraft. There were lots of L-1011s flying for Eastern and other airlines. Just as there had been human survivors of the crash of Flight 401, large portions of the plane itself survived without serious damage. After the investigations, the parts of the L-1011 that had been Flight 401 and that were still in working order were used as spare parts for other L-1011s in Eastern's flight. Just as parts of a wrecked car may be used to repair other cars, it's the same with airplanes. In fact, it's even more common with airplanes, since parts for them are a lot more expensive. Within a few months after the crash, strange rumors began to circulate among Eastern Airlines employees. The ghosts of Captain Bob Loft and Flight Engineer Don Repo, who had been killed in the crash of Flight 401, were being seen on other Eastern flights. The reports came mainly from an L-1011 with a number 318, a plane almost identical to the one that had crashed in the Everglades in December 1972. Many of those who saw the apparitions had known the dead men before the crash, so they were quick to recognize them. The airline employees did not want to talk publicly about their experiences. They were afraid that people would think they were crazy, and in turn, they might lose their jobs. After all, who wants to fly on an airplane with a crazy crew? The airline did not want to talk about the rumors either. Who wants to fly on a haunted airplane? Well, me perhaps, but who else? But the airline employees talked to one another, and they told the stories to their friends and relatives. So, rumors of the ghosts got around. Eventually, the rumors were heard by a writer named John Fuller. He set out to investigate. At first, people would not talk to him, but eventually they loosened up, and he collected some pretty astonishing accounts. On one flight, the flight engineer was going through his routine pre-flight inspection. He saw a man wearing the uniform of an Eastern Airlines flight engineer sitting in his seat. Immediately, he recognized the man as the now-dead Don Repo. The apparition of Repo said something like, "You don't need to worry about the pre-flight. I've already done it." Immediately after, the figure vanished. One flight was actually canceled after the pilot and two flight attendants encountered the ghost of Captain Loft in the first class compartment. In another incident, the flight attendant was making a final head count of the passengers. She counted one extra in the first class. She figured it was the fellow in the Eastern Airlines uniform. Airline employees are often able to ride free if seats are available, but they do need a special boarding pass and most check in. The flight attendant tried to talk to the man, but he stared straight ahead and didn't answer. She called the pilot, who came to look at the silent man, and shouted, "My God, it's Bob Loft!" With that, the figure in the seat vanished before everyone's eyes. During a flight on an L-1011, one of the flight attendants discovered that an oven used for heating meals had an overloaded circuit. A man in an engineer's uniform appeared and fixed the oven. A few minutes later, another engineer showed up, and when he was told that the oven had already been fixed, he insisted that he was the only engineer on this flight. Later, the flight attendant identified a photo of Don Repo as the man who had fixed the oven. On a plane approaching Miami International Airport over the Everglades, the same path taken by the ill-fated Flight 401, a voice came over the PA system to announce the usual seatbelt and no smoking rules to passengers and crew. But no one in the regular crew made that announcement. In fact, the PA system was not even turned on during that period. These are just a few of the dozens of accounts that Fuller collected for his book, The Ghost of Flight 401, which I highly recommend. Fuller felt that the majority of the encounters with the ghosts of Captain Loft or Don Repo had occurred on one particular plane, number 318. Because that flight used a large number of salvaged parts from the crashed plane. Other L-1011s on which there had also been sightings of the ghosts had also used parts from the Flight 401 plane. Though those who saw the figures of Captain Loft or Flight Engineer Repo were usually quite shaken, the ghosts themselves do not seem to have been at all menacing. In fact, they seem to want to be helpful in a small way, like fixing an oven or making an announcement about fastening seatbelts. Still, the airline employees wish that they could go away. Even a helpful ghost can be very unsettling. Finally, some of the people who had seen the apparitions felt that they were able to get in touch with the spirit of Don Repo through the use of a Ouija board and confirm his spectral work on the flights. Eventually, the number of sightings dwindled and faded away. Perhaps these men, these ghostly figures, only wanted to prevent another disaster from happening. I first heard these stories about Flight 401 when I was a child, and I was highly fascinated. It always made me wonder and made me want to fly a haunted plane myself, although that's not happened. It's still a really very cool story. After all, a helpful ghost is something very amazing to have around. I have a few of those in my own house. Who knows? Maybe you have some too. And now there's time for one other story. A nice, creepy, scary story. Even the title gives me the shivers. It's called Something in the Room. Ancient castles and grand manor houses in England often have a haunted room. That's the bedroom where they never put guests because some ancestor or other was murdered there, and his or her ghost continues to haunt the room and disturb the sleep of the guests. Guests who spend a night in the haunted room sometimes die of fright or go insane. At the very least, they flee the castle the next morning, never to return. While that's fine for castles, certainly one does not expect to find a horribly haunted room in a small frame house. Not in Detroit, USA, and not in 1961. Yet, that's just what happened with auto worker Bill Cole and his family, which they found to their own horror. Bill purchased the house partly because it had a small back bedroom. He was employed at the Cadillac assembly plant, and he often worked the night shift. That meant he came home in the morning and had to sleep during the day. The Coles had three active and noisy children, so Bill was finding it pretty hard to sleep during the day in their old house. The new house, a gray frame building on Martin Street, had this small back bedroom. It was isolated from the rest of the house. The room looked as if it had been added to the house after the original structure was built. It was so small that you could just about squeeze a single bed into it. It also had a tiny closet, but with a bed in the room, you couldn't even open the closet door completely. The only way to get into the room was through a door from the kitchen. Not very convenient, but Bill thought it would be perfect for his needs. No one would bother him back there. The first week in his new house, Bill tried the room out. He came home in the morning from his work on the night shift and went to the little bedroom, climbed into bed, and promptly fell asleep. A few minutes later, he was in the grip of the worst and most lifelike nightmare he had ever experienced. In his dream, he had walked over to the closet door, opened it slowly, and looked inside. Inside was a bloody and horribly mutilated corpse propped up against the wall. Bill woke up covered with sweat, and his heart was pounding wildly. Bill tried to pass the whole thing off as the result of the excitement of moving and the disruptions of his irregular work schedule. Still, it took him a few minutes to get the courage to actually check the closet. It was empty. After this, he found it difficult to get back to sleep again. The horrifying dream recurred every time Bill went to sleep in the back bedroom. He was now so tired that his work at the auto plant was suffering. He finally just gave up trying to sleep in the room and went back to sleeping in the main bedroom. There, his sleep was untroubled. He didn't go into any details about why he didn't go into the little room anymore. He just told his wife, Lillian, that he did not feel comfortable there. Bill soon became completely adjusted to sleeping in the main bedroom during the day. The sounds of his children playing or other daytime noises did not bother him anymore. And the memory of those horrible dreams that he had when sleeping in the back bedroom began to fade. After all, everything else about this house seemed perfectly ordinary and normal. Bill pushed the whole experience to the back of his mind and treated it as some sort of odd but temporary event. As far as he was concerned, it was all over. In the late summer of 1962, Bill's mother came for a visit. Bill's wife suggested that she sleep in the little back bedroom rather than on a couch in the living room. Lillian pointed out that they had a perfectly good empty room. Why have Grandma Cole sleep on the couch? Bill was a bit uneasy, but he told himself that the bad dreams were his problem and had nothing to do with the room. 2 days later, Grandma Cole cut short her visit and was on her way back to Georgia. She didn't have nightmares, but she was kept awake by a thumping sound coming from the closet. It filled her with a feeling of dread, and she was convinced that something was in the closet hammering on the door, trying to get out. She also felt that if she opened the closet door, it, whatever it was, would get her. No one else heard the thumping. Looking in the closet and seeing it was empty did little to calm her fears. She knew what she heard and felt. Not only wouldn't she stay in the room, she didn't even want to stay in the house anymore. For the first time, Bill sat down and told his wife what he had experienced. Lillian admitted that she too often felt uncomfortable when she went in to clean the room, and she did so rarely as possible. They noticed that their dog, normally an extremely brave little terrier, avoided the room entirely. So did the children, who usually got into everything. When they were asked about it, the children could not be sure why they didn't go into the back room, just only say it was a feeling they had. They didn't like it. Bill locked the door to the room and decided never to use it again. But he also felt a bit foolish giving in to these superstitious fears. In October 1962, Bill's old friend Dick Patterson visited the Cole house. Patterson was the calmest, most level-headed person that the Coles knew, so they decided to put him in the back bedroom. But they did not tell him about what had happened to others. They didn't want him to be influenced. Patterson went to bed about 11 p.m. Sometime shortly after midnight, he woke up. He felt someone was trying to shake him or turn him over. The bedroom door, which led to the kitchen, was open. He distinctly remembered having closed it before he went to bed. But now, in the doorway, was the figure of a woman. She had her back turned to Patterson and was apparently staring out into the kitchen. At first, Patterson assumed that the figure was Lillian Cole, but the hair was different, and the woman was wearing what appeared to be a long blue dress and a short fur coat. Not the sort of clothes he had ever seen Lillian wear. Patterson got out of bed and walked toward the figure, but before he reached it, all the lights in the house went out. A few seconds later, they went on again. Patterson was in the kitchen. Lillian was there. She was washing her hair in the sink. The mysterious figure in the doorway had disappeared. Patterson tried to explain to Lillian what had happened, but she didn't need an explanation. She confessed to Patterson that a lot of strange things had already happened in that back bedroom. As the two stood talking in the kitchen, they heard strange and awful howling noises coming from the back bedroom. Then came a choking smell, the smell of rotting flesh, making both of them sick. The most frightening thing of all was that of a trap door to the cellar that was located in a utility room off the kitchen began to rise slowly and then suddenly slam shut. Lillian grabbed the phone and called the police. When the police arrived, they were suspicious. They thought someone might be playing a joke on them. But they were impressed by Lillian's and Patterson's obvious sincerity and equally obvious fear. The police carefully searched the whole house, including the back bedroom and the cellar, but they found nothing out of the ordinary. When Bill came home from work the next morning, he found his wife and friends still sitting in the kitchen discussing what had happened that night. Bill was thoroughly ashamed of himself. He had put his mother in the haunted room and then put his best friend there. Now he was determined to settle the matter once and for all. He was going to go back into that room and spend the night. Since he wasn't scheduled to work for 2 days, he waited until evening to go into the room. He figured that since he was very tired, he would sleep straight through if nothing happened. He got into the bed that evening, and despite all his previous troubles sleeping in the room, he dropped right off. After about an hour, he was awakened by a noise in the room. In the semi-darkness, he saw the shape of a woman standing near the door. He thought it was Lillian, and he called loudly to her. The figure turned, but it was not Lillian. It wasn't even human anymore. Whatever it was had the face of a rotting corpse. The figure moved toward him and held its face just a few inches from his own. It appeared to be trying to speak, but all that came out were hissing sounds. Bill jumped out of bed, and somehow, in the narrow confines of that tiny room, he managed to get past the hideous figure without touching it, and ran into the kitchen. He was hysterical. Patterson and Lillian had to throw a blanket around him to keep him from rushing out into the street and possibly hurting himself. No one else in the house saw the terrible figure. It's possible that Bill just had another of those realistic dreams. It's possible that all of the other things that were supposed to have happened in that house could have natural explanations. But Bill Cole no longer cared. The very next day, the family packed up and moved in with Lillian's parents in the suburbs. The frame house was put up for sale. The real estate agent never told prospective buyers why the last family had moved out so abruptly, and no one else who has lived there has ever experienced any of the strange and terrible phenomena that afflicted the Coles. That was a fantastic, horrifying story to end the episode with, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did when I first heard it. It's very creepy. I wonder if that house is still there in good old Detroit. Maybe someone from there can let us know. I wonder if perhaps you would be willing to spend a night in that back bedroom yourself. I think I'll pass, even though I do love a good ghost story. And so, it comes to the end of our episode, and I thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to visit myhauntedolls.com, the Redbubble store, and also visit and subscribe to youtube.com/myhauntedolls. And tune in again in a few weeks when I come back for some more chilling tales of terror. Until then, happy hauntings.